The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Good morning. You're listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. Coming up on the Best of the Book Nook, we're going to go back to 2002, and we're going to do some shopping. Do you like to shop? Well, you might be a woman. Do you hate to shop? Well, you might be a man. According to Thomas Hine, back in 2002, two-thirds of men hate to shop, two-thirds of women love to shop. I don't know if that's changed, but we're going to be talking to Thomas Hine, or at least we did back in 2002, for his new book back then called I Want That, How We All Became Shoppers, A Cultural History. That's coming up on the Best of the Book Nook. Stay tuned. Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McKeonis. Back in 2002, I interviewed a guy named Thomas Hine. He had a book out called I Want That, How We All Became Shoppers, A Cultural History. We did this interview right between Thanksgiving and Christmas, and I thought about running it again during that same time frame, but then I thought, people are so overwhelmed by shopping at that time of year, I needed to give everybody a break. So we saved this until now, because now is the time when a lot of people aren't shopping and we're getting ready to see those President's Day's ads. I know someone who has mentioned just a couple of times recently that these recliners in the house are unacceptable. One of them, the cat's is scratched up, and the other one makes a bunch of noise when you recline in it, and they need to be replaced. And do I want to go shopping for new recliners? And I'm so excited about that. I shop like a guy. I used to really like to shop, particularly when they had a lot of record stores to shop in when I was younger. But now, not so much. And since we did this interview, one thing has really changed. This was recorded back in the early days of the internet when online shopping really had not become what it is now. And it's interesting to hear him talk about the internet and online shopping. Let's revisit this interview now with Thomas Hine. We're not going to shop for recliners, but we're going to shop for a lot of other things in the Best of the Book Nook.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McKeonis, and today my guest is Thomas Hine. His book is called I Want That, How We All Became Shoppers, A Cultural History. Welcome to the program, Tom.
Good to be here on, Vic.
Tom, what's the deal? Why did you write this book? What's so fascinating about shopping?
Well, it all started a few years ago when an editor at the Washington Post called me up, and she said, look, we have it's Thanksgiving. We're about to have a paper that's going to be about 5 pounds of ads. And we have a story here by a very famous writer about how what a terrible thing shopping is. She said, if it's so terrible, then everybody here involved with the Post, pretty much everybody involved in the whole system, is sort of morally bankrupt. Tom, can you possibly think of something good to say about shopping? And I thought about it, and I found enough to write the 1,500-word article, and then I started thinking more and more and more about really the very important role that shopping plays in our lives and how deeply it is as part of the way we think, the way we go through our lives. And so that's where the book came from.
Well, it seems appropriate that it would come out at this time of the year.
Yeah, well, that's on purpose.
Oh, okay. This is the time of year between, say, Thanksgiving and New Year's when merchants in this country are hopeful that they'll cash in on, what, 25% of their yearly sales?
Yeah, it's somewhere between 25 and 30. It depends year to year. And, of course, they'd, you know, when the Christmas holidays first took off in the latter half of the 19th century, some merchants actually fought it. that they didn't want to have. I mean, it was, they wouldn't, you know, merchants wouldn't have invented Christmas the way it is now, where you basically get all of your profits in a very small part of the year, and you have all kinds of problems with inventory, and you have to hire on more staff, and there's traffic, and all sorts of things. But there is, you know, I think the Christmas, we underrate Christmas as a kind of a popular event, one that came from the people rather than from the merchants.
So it's really kind of a make-or-break thing for a lot of merchants. I know many merchants are very nervous this time of year because, as you pointed out, there are all those problems, and if you don't rack up those sales, it could impact your entire year and your business.
Absolutely, and there are other businesses, for example, newspapers, that don't make a profit until the third quarter because they're dependent on retail advertising.
I was fascinated to read your book and discover that the history of Christmas in this country really began about 1830. I didn't realize that the Puritans didn't celebrate Christmas.
Yeah, the Puritans didn't, and I live in Philadelphia. The Quakers didn't either, although Philadelphia is one of the places where celebration of Christmas started because Germans did. And, of course, the German celebration of Christmas also influenced the English celebration of Christmas because Prince Albert, Queen Victoria's consort, was German. And so Prince Albert and Queen Victoria had sort of the first English-speaking Christmas tree sometime in the 1830s. And that made it kind of more made Christmas more respectable sort of for people who were English-speaking.
And Christmas, in a way, was an attempt to co-opt more pagan holidays like Saturnalia, and the whole thing with the Christmas tree comes from tree worshiping.
Yeah, yeah, and of course, yeah, and that of course goes way back. But I mean, I in thinking about Christmas, I really think about the Christmas that we know today, and to realize that, you know, as you say, in about 1830, people didn't celebrate it. There was a gift-giving holiday among many people, basically the well-to-do, and that was New Year's Day. That the people to whom you gave gifts at Christmas were part of this kind of ancient tradition that, in fact, does go back to the Roman Saturnalia, where the people who are stronger give to the weak, and that ties in, of course, with the whole. The iconography of the wise men coming to the manger and giving gifts to the Christ child, but how it translated in early 19th century America is if you had a servant working for you, Christmas is the time that you would give them some sort of a present.
And that was the Christmas box, and that really is the true spirit of Christmas, at least the early American version.
And of course, it lives on in these things that we consider to be semi-coerced, like, you know, the person who delivers your newspaper sends you a Christmas card, which you know has to be returned with a tip. This kind of coercion of gifts is really one of the more ancient traditions of Christmas, going all the way back to the Middle Ages.
And that comes from what, the mummers?
Yeah, in part. I mean, mummers are one part of it. Even Saturnalia, of course, there was a kind of a ritual changing of places, and the slaves served the masters at least in a symbolic way for that one day.
My guest is Thomas Hine. The book is I Want That, How We All Became Shoppers, A Cultural History. So why do we do it, Tom? Why do we put ourselves through this, particularly those of us who are men?
You mean Christmas shopping?
Any shopping.
Well. I mean, I think I have to make a distinction.
Uh-huh.
Christmas shopping is a really special case because most cultures seem to have some kind of gift-giving holiday, and I think the reason that we do it is that it forces people to evaluate the relationships they have with other people, and then to make some physical show of that relationship, give some physical token of that relationship that embodies the relationship. And that's why Christmas shopping is so stressful, because it's so easy to make a mistake that your understanding of what the relationship is may not be the other person's. Your understanding of who the person is, you know, if it's somebody you only see at Christmas, you know, things may have changed in that last year and you don't really, really understand. But nevertheless, the difficulty of Christmas, of the crowds and of the shopping and so forth, is also a part of the point, because it shows that you're willing to make a sacrifice for members of your family and other people that you view as being near to you.
And it's a way to keep up that connection, say, with far-flung family members who we maybe don't pay enough attention to the rest of the year.
Well, exactly. And if you didn't have that, you know, probably a lot of your relationships would just kind of wither away.
My guess is Thomas Hine. You analyze the shopping habits of contemporary men and women, and you found a lot of differences. I was intrigued by this, and I also was amazed by the disparity between men who shop online and men who try to shop in other venues.
Well, you know, obviously there are both men and women. There are some men love to shop and some women hate to shop. But in general, women take shopping much more seriously than men do. And about two-thirds of women say they like to shop, whereas only about a third of men do. One, I think, perhaps the most important reason for that is that girls are brought up to shop and to take shopping seriously. And this goes back, in a way, to the same kind of forces that brought the origin of Christmas, that in the sort of the second third of the 19th century, you had a change in the society where work moved outside of the home, and that became primarily the father's responsibility, whereas the woman was in the home, and it was her job to create the physical circumstances of the household, that, what it was decorated with, what people would eat, everything. She became the sort of consumer-in-chief. And obviously, in the 19th century, she had to know how to do a lot of things that made things work, of cooking a lot of things from scratch, sewing, all sorts of things. What's happened over the last 150 years is each of these skills has moved out into being something not so much that you have to do within the household, but that you can shop for. So the nurturing of your family is primarily a matter of choosing what they're going to wear, what they're going to eat, what they're going to sit on, what is going to be all their physical circumstances, and that is obtained through shopping.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the best of the Book Nook on 91.3 WYSO, fact-based journalism in service of democracy, going back to an interview I did in 2002 with Thomas Hine. We were talking about shopping. I love to shop for groceries. I'm okay with that, but I shop like a guy. I'm not a real big shopper. And we were just getting ready to talk about online shopping for groceries, which in 2002 was pretty weird, and we're going to bring you that segment right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO. Thomas Hine was on the program back in 2002. We were talking about shopping, and you might recall 25 years ago, there were some very ambitious companies that tried to do online shopping for groceries. And they didn't really know what they were doing, and some of these enterprises failed dramatically. And we talked about some of this online shopping for groceries 24 years ago in the Book Nook. Let's listen.
I started this book at the moment when it was believed that the shopping online was going to change human nature.
Uh-huh.
And people were betting billions of dollars on that, and my guess was that it wasn't, and I was right perhaps sooner than was convenient for me.
Uh-huh.
But the whole question of not only was it grocery shopping online, which in fact may work, but it was that you had to bid for your groceries online, and you weren't necessarily assured that you would get the brand that you wanted. In other words, you bid for detergent, but you didn't know whether you'd get Tide or Dynamo.
Or how much it would cost.
Or how much it would cost. Well, you said, I'm willing to pay so much for our detergent, and they'd say, well, we can sell it to you for that. What would you, do you want to buy it? And then they would tell you, you've bought a detergent that nobody's ever heard of.
So that was perhaps a little overambitious on their part. And who wants to go to all that bother to pick up consumer items?
Yeah, I mean, that was the real problem, that it wasn't so much, in a way, the shopping online for groceries that I was reacting to, as it was to an article in the Wall Street Journal by an economist who said that, basically, thank heaven, we are moving past the age of fixed prices, which were an unintended consequence of the Industrial Revolution, and are economically stupid.
Mm-hmm.
However, what he was saying was that everything that we buy in our lives should be bargained for, and that is psychologically stupid, because it means we have to spend altogether too much effort, and what it then means is that we're going to buy less, pushing down the level of economic activity.
Hmm. My guest is Thomas Hine. The book is I Want That, How We All Became Shoppers, A Cultural History. It's just been published by HarperCollins. He joins us by telephone from Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. Tom, I was really amused by a number of things in the book. You described going out and shopping for a vacuum cleaner, and I think this is an experience that is probably in common with a lot of other men.
Yeah, I mean, that I perhaps am a little bit atypical in that I generally like to shop, but sometimes I really find that I do shop like a guy. And this was one of those times where I went to buy this vacuum cleaner, and the problem was just from the very beginning that I really didn't feel this was something I ought to have to do. I went in there and I just sort of became confused by it all, because you could tell which vacuum cleaners were more expensive more or less by the color of their shell, that the most expensive vacuum cleaners had colors like expensive cars, sort of like Jaguar green vacuum cleaners. And then I started going with numbers, and there were some that were so many watts, and there were some that were so many volts, and I started trying to go back to my high school physics, trying to think what in the world can all of this mean.
Uh-huh.
And then I came upon one that said Mach 2.7.
Ah, that's a man's vacuum there.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Well, that means it goes at 2.7 times the speed of sound, which I knew was unlikely. But maybe it was the macho, Mach became macho. At any rate, it was on sale, and so I bought it. But in the end, I kind of shut my eyes and said, oh, gee, I'm going to do it. It's on sale. I'll buy it. And get this over with. That's what men, when they shop in the real world, tend to want to do, is get it over with. You were mentioning the disparities between men and women online, and that's an interesting thing, that women, when they shop, their attention is on more things. They're more playful. They look around. They have kind of a lot of peripheral vision. They're open to discovery, whereas men tend to focus in on one thing and make their escape. On the internet, at least until recently, the behavior on the internet is changing rapidly. But what was happening is that women shop the internet like a man. They go there, they find exactly the thing they want. And there's no place better than the internet for finding exactly the thing you want.
Uh-huh.
and then leave, whereas men tend to be playful and kind of tend to click from site to site and kind of keep looking around. So they behave on the internet more like women do in department stores. And that makes a certain amount of sense because the department store, even the whole shopping mall, is essentially a feminine place, whereas the internet has generally been a masculine place.
So on the internet, the men, at least, tend to be more hunter-gatherers, whereas the women are more hunter-gatherers in the actual shopping venues. You take a look at the roots of hunter and gathering societies, and you looked at this group of women who still exist, who can walk along with the baby, and they walk 1,500 miles a year gathering 80 different kinds of seeds and bugs. And this was pretty fascinating stuff. It helped me to understand what you were talking about as far as women being able to multitask when they're out there shopping and the baby is screaming and they're focusing on what they want to buy.
Yeah, I found one study that said that basically children don't impede women who are shopping at all. But husbands do, substantially. And, it may be that this what people call the shopping gene is just the ability that women acquire of being attentive to several things at the same time, whereas men tend to, what tends to be valued in men is the ability to focus. And focus is not always the best thing It's better to kind of be vaguely attentive as a shopper, maybe, than it is to be focused.
My guest is Thomas Hine. The book is I Want That, How We All Became Shoppers, A Cultural History. Where did you come upon this information about this group of primitive hunter-gatherers?
I spent some time at the library at the University Museum here in Philadelphia, which is a distinguished archaeological and anthropological library.
Okay.
And so this most of this comes out of journals, and basically the business of hunters and gatherers I felt that I had to deal with, because as I was doing the research, there were so much I depended a lot on marketing studies, but for the most part they're not very rigorous or thought through, or in some cases totally believable.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the kind of cliches is, you know, that men are hunters and focused, and they're out there with spears and they kill the mammoths, and women are gatherers, and there that means they have to look for a lot more different things, and that's the reason for the difference. And then I realized that this whole idea of hunters and gatherers is just a very recent, which is to say in the last 40 years, concept.
Uh-huh.
And it mirrors contemporary, the reason that it seems to explain contemporary life is I think that it mirrors the development of kind of suburban society during the 1950s and 60s, rather than that it really describes how people lived in Neolithic times.
My guest is Thomas Hine, who's a bit of a hunter and gatherer himself, based on reading your book, I'm guessing.
More of a gatherer.
His book is called I Want That, How We All Became Shoppers, A Cultural History, published by HarperCollins. He does have a website. It's thomashine.com. And I see you've written some other books, including a book that I understand had a pretty good following, Populux. Tell us how you got into this line of work and tell us about some of your other work.
Well, for a long time, for about 25 years, I was the architecture and design critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Oh.
And so I wrote an awful lot of articles about, mostly about buildings and about planning and the way the and about historic preservation. And I realized that Populux is still in print, but it first came out in 1986, and that was a period that some of you may remember Ronald Reagan was president, and there was a desire to define the 1950s as the period of normality to which we should restore our nation.
Uh-huh.
And what I started thinking about that, and I, and my conclusion was the opposite, that the 50s were a profoundly abnormal time for a number of reasons, both demographic and economic. They were remarkable and interesting, but never to be repeated again. And so I decided to look at the 1950s and 60s, basically the period from 54 to 64, through buildings, cars, chairs, and what they said about how people viewed life at that time.
Okay. Well, we seem to attract architectural writers to this program. We had Brendan Gill on once. He used to write for The New Yorker on architecture. And
mm-hmm.
Larry Millette, he used to write for the St. Paul paper. He's now writing mysteries. So you guys are thick out there, you architectural types.
Yeah, well, what we tend to do is wander off into other things. That the occupational hazard of the architectural critic is to become a social critic.
Okay. My guess is, Thomas Hine, you referred to the 50s, and I'm sure many of our listeners remember that era. I can remember going to department stores with my grandmother back in the heyday when the department store was really, really a place, really a salon. And you talk about a friend's experience shopping for clothing in the 50s in some grand department store where the sales lady knew you and knew generations of your family and knew your friends, and it was really a full-service experience that she misses, yet she realizes this could not be today.
Yeah, that it was actually, this was actually a very famous store. Really, it was not so much a department store as a specialty store, a women's specialty store, which is where you got the most intense kind of service. Although, I mean, but yeah, she told me that she just doesn't have, would never have the patience for it. And also, she doesn't have the kind of life that at the time she was talking about going to buy a dress at this store, she was living in a much more closed society, that she would be buying a dress to go to a party. The saleswoman would know other people who were going to the same party.
Uh-huh.
And tell her, no, don't buy that dress because so-and-so is buying that dress.
Well, I, for one, miss the days of good service when you went to a store and the people knew you and knew what you were looking for, and they would lead you to it and they would take care of you. I really do miss that. I can remember a number of years ago, I managed a record store, and we were in a college area where we had two other stores competing with us in the same block area, so service was very important. We would all get the same music in on the same day every week. The difference between you selling a copy of an album and the guy across the street was knowing your customer. Your customer would come in, and you knew your customer liked this particular performing artist, and you would lead them over to the album, and you'd go, hey, look, we've got the new Michael Jackson or whatever. We've got the new Daniel Barenboim album. You would provide that extra level of service, and this would help you to sell things, which pushed you into profitability.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. Of course, now we have the computer softwares that are just now becoming effective. See, what got in your way as a salesperson, probably in analyzing the taste, was that you were logical. You would say, well, if you like this, well, then this is sort of like this, and so you will like that. These new kind of collective filtering software that they're being used by Amazon and some others don't have logic. They just find patterns. So they say, well, if you like these two record albums and then these three books, then you'll like this sweater.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And they are actually, if you are willing, I'm kind of not quite so willing to give up my privacy that way. I don't want them. I don't like the idea of this, that they know this about me. But
yeah.
If you are willing to give them a rich enough variety of your your preferences, they can surprise you in interesting ways. They won't always be right, but they will usually give you interesting surprises.
Well, you have a funny story about a friend of yours who got a book recommended to him that way.
It was a book of erotic drawings of what I would view as a slightly kinky cast. And I don't know that and he was delighted because he lives in a small town where they probably wouldn't stock the book, and two, where people like you and your bookstore, people would know him, and he wouldn't want to be seen buying that book among the people who would know him in the small town. And so to find that the computer understood him well enough to recommend this book and that he could get it in relative privacy, he found to be a really useful kind of sales attention, a new kind, and he loved it.
But he'd never bought anything like this. How did the computer figure this out?
He had probably bought some things that the way the computer figures it out is that it says people who've bought A, B, C, D, and E sometimes buy F.
Okay.
And it doesn't matter what they are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the computer can be wrong. Some of the time it is, but enough of the time it's going to be right that it at least interests you, and so you can take a look at the suggestions.
It's sort of frightening to me. My guest is Thomas Hine. The book is I Want That, How We All Became Shoppers, A Cultural History.
It's the best of the Book Nook on WYSO. We've got one more segment of this interview with Thomas Hine coming up right after this. And we're getting ready to close out the best of the Book Nook for this week. And this is an interview I did back in 2002 with a guy named Thomas Hine for his book, I Want That.
With the conglomeration of media, we have all of this stuff going on where cable companies and online providers, they're all getting mixed up into one big bundle. I had a friend who I talked to the other day who had just had cable installed, and he didn't really read the thing that he signed to agree to accept the cable, and he was a little nervous that he had agreed to really sell a lot of consumer information when he signed this document, because they know what you're doing. They know everywhere that you go. They know everything that you watch.
Of course, it's long been possible to follow it through your credit card records.
Uh-huh.
The things that you might look for, I mean, that's a mark of real sincerity because you've actually bought it.
My guest is Thomas Hine. Tell us what you mean by the biosphere.
Well, I think I was looking for a way to talk about the fact that the biosphere is sort of the sum total of all of our main streets, shopping malls, internet sites, commercial television, that everywhere where we are being importuned to buy.
Uh-huh.
And the reason I thought there was just a need to be able to talk about all of these different venues so that we would understand that the act of shopping is multidimensional, and that we're shopping in some sense even when we don't think we're shopping, that we're taking in information about things that we might eventually buy. We're being exposed, even when we go to the movies where there's no commercials, we're being exposed to things that we might really want to have in our own lives and so forth. But the other thing about it, of course, is that the biosphere is really the most hospitable realm. It's where, you know, the commercial areas of cities are where strangers are most welcome, and there's the most color and life and so forth. That kind of civic centers tend not to be very interesting, but the commercial centers tend to be very welcoming. And so I wanted to kind of emphasize this aspect of things too, that that in some ways the biosphere is very one-dimensional, in that people are trying to sell you things, but because they are, they're willing to be more hospitable, to offer more color and life, and they're more sensual because you get to feel things and smell things and taste things.
My guest is Thomas Hine, and as you mentioned, at this very moment, listeners are listening to a radio program. They're thinking about shopping, but the end result could be that they're walking through a bookstore and they see your book and they go, I want that.
I certainly hope so. I mean, one of the things that I find odd, I mean, I'm not arguing that all shopping is good, or that there's no problem with the environment and with the waste of materials and with people buying things that aren't really suitable for them and spending too much money and not saving enough. I don't deny that there are problems with shopping at all. But on the other hand, I think that it's so deeply a part of what people do, because it's a way in which we really find ourselves. We discover our identities. We try things on. We try on possibilities. It's a really wonderfully optimistic act. And I couldn't imagine, it would seem to me to be so hypocritical to be an author. You know, and basically all authors are slaving to try to get people to buy their books. To be an author, to say it's bad to buy everything, except, of course, my book.
Well, the only exception, I think, was Abby Hoffman.
Yes.
You remember his book?
Steal It. Steal
yeah.
This book.
Apparently that was a shoplifter's favorite. Actually, shoplifting is a form of shopping, isn't it?
Well, it's kind of interesting. We had this recent celebrity story about shoplifting.
Winona.
And she was typical of the shoplifter in one way, in which was that she tended to shoplift from places that she liked. She shoplifted from places that she shopped at.
Uh-huh.
And it was interesting that shoplifting numbers went way down in the late 90s when which was the first time basically since the 70s that real personal income was going up at the lower levels of, you know, throughout the society, real personal income was going up. Shoplifting went way down because people were buying the things that they might otherwise have stolen. Obviously, I assume Winona was not in economic need, however, for her shoplifting.
That's a very bizarre story. I don't know what to make of that whole thing.
Well, it's a funny thing. It's a recurrent story because there have been previous celebrity shoplifting scandals, as mm-hmm. you know.
My guest is Thomas Hine. The book is I Want That, How We All Became Shoppers. Thomas, if I'm hearing you, you said that you realize there are problems with shopping, but overall you're for it. You also make the point in the book that because of some of these problems and people having a hard time dealing with our consumer society, that we have this movement towards voluntary simplicity. And you look at that.
Yes, well, there's voluntary simplicity, but there's also kind of high consumption simplicity. You know, like Real Simple magazine, for example. And there are a number, now they're getting to be a whole group of magazines that are aimed at selling products to people that purport to help them live a simpler life.
Uh-huh.
That people being kind of overwhelmed by consumerism is itself emerging as a market.
It's a new niche. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's actually not even a new niche. It's one that I think it relates very strongly to the arts and crafts movement of about 100 years ago. The same there was, and then it, and even earlier to, well, to the arts and crafts movement in the United States, and then earlier to the arts and crafts movement in England, you know, in which Ruskin was deriding, I'm sorry, William Morris, I was deriding, industrial society and calling for a return to medieval craftsmanship.
Yeah, there was a guy named Liberty. I had never heard of him.
Yeah, well, that's a great store. It's still a great store in London. Arthur Lazenby Liberty, who was, I argue, one of the first, if not the first, certainly one of the first people to understand that a counterculture could also be a good market. And he was appealing to people who were in the mid-19th century declaring themselves to be aesthetes, people who were trying to rise above just the tremendous amount of ugly merchandise that was coming out and celebrating things that were fewer and more beautiful. Probably the most famous aesthete is Oscar Wilde.
Yeah.
And Liberty understood that these people who wanted simpler but finer things were really a very good market because they were willing to pay more for the fewer things that they wanted.
So they wanted quality and not quantity.
Yeah, but they ended up with quantity, too.
Okay, which was sort of a Victorian thing, wasn't it? Wasn't clutter really a Victorian attribute?
It certainly, well, yeah, it certainly was in the kind of layering of stuff and the layering of one drapery over another drapery. On the other hand, I don't think that the Victorians could really compete with early 21st century Americans when it came to leading cluttered lives.
Okay. Well, it's a fascinating book, and I love the fact that you go back into all this history and people like Liberty. I'd never heard of, obviously, Stickley's well-known in this country, but you talk about that whole arts and crafts movement and how it lasted for 75 years, which is amazing in itself.
Yes, and as I say, it's being revived in all these very odd ways today, through Martha Stewart, in a way, as another arts and crafts entrepreneur.
I see you've written for Martha Stewart Living. There's someone who's been in the news recently, not necessarily for all the right reasons.
Yeah, I've never met Martha Stewart, much less received any stock tips from her. So I'm not going to go into that. I really enjoy writing for the magazine. I write about for them. I write about collecting and what it does is it puts me in touch with people who are really enthusiasts in kind of very narrow areas of knowledge, like picnic baskets, you know.
Sure.
And so I have fun writing those articles. They're good. The people that I know there are good.
I know what you're saying. In fact, we had someone on this program once with a Martha Stewart book, and she actually knew Martha, but Martha wasn't coming out to Yellow Springs to do book events, so we talked to her surrogate. And it was fine. It was very interesting.
Well, I mean, the thing is the thing about the arts and crafts movement is that, you know, that it does celebrate doing something well.
Mm-hmm.
And there's probably very few products that are, you know, very few consumer publications that are kind of so meticulous as that magazine.
Yeah.
Well, for better and worse.
Sure. Well, Tom, we really appreciate your time today and your book.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed being here.
The book is I Want That, How We All Became Shoppers, A Cultural History, published by HarperCollins. Thomas Hine wrote it, and he has a website. It's thomashine.com. And from the Book Nook, this time of year, I guess all I can say is happy shopping.
Well, happy shopping to you. And keep I Want That in mind.
Okay. Hey, if you could hold the phone, you've been listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for tuning in.
Don't touch that dial. We have a few minutes left on the program today to tell you about what's coming up tomorrow in the Book Nook. That was Thomas Hine talking about his book, I Want That. And back in 1997, I did my first interview with James Lee Burke. 30 years later, we're going to do interview number 25. That's tomorrow. He is just publishing his longest Dave Robichaux novel, It's called The How to Call Boogie. And I want to read you the beginning because James Lee Burke, who will turn 90 in December, is still in fine form as a writer. Here's the opening. The events in this tale occurred very close to the turn of the century, when some early celebrants were popping rockets and raining sparks on Bayou Teche, although the tree frogs paid them no mind and droned with such volume, the night air seemed to have a voice of its own. Who would have thought such complexity would fall upon us? As usual, the Acadian Saturnalia was a grand and innocent mix of paganism and Christianity. The breeze balmy, smelling of fish roe, more like spring than winter, more like a fecund and pastoral piece of Eden that had drifted loose from the South Seas. But for me, lying on top of my bed in my shotgun house that creaked with loneliness, listening to the long-dead voice of Jimmy Rogers yodeling in the dark, I wondered about the plantation world in which I was born and the one in which I now lived. Sometimes I felt the year was 1861, although my Acadian family certainly did not descend from the agrarian aristocracy that readers of Gone with the Wind would associate with the historical South. Both my parents were illiterate, although my mother wanted terribly to learn. Education of any kind was a luxury in the world in which she lived. She worked in a laundry for 20 cents an hour alongside black women who spoke no English at all. My father's world was certainly more lucrative, but more severe in its own fashion. He racked pipe on the monkey board of an offshore drilling rig and thought his drinking and womanizing in carefree ways under the stars would never end, until the drill punched into an early pay sand and blew oil and gas in half the Gulf of Mexico through the rig, the floor spikes popping like corks, pipe clanging and bouncing in the network of steel stanchions. My father hooked his safety belt on the Geronimo wire and leaped into the darkness just as the wellhead exploded, sending a ball of flame into the heavens and taking my father down to the bottom of the Gulf, the heat boiling the surface, the bodies of the dead bobbing in the waves, their faces burned off, the unlit oil as black and shiny as paint, rolling in the waves. Those were the kinds of images floating through my mind while Jimmy Rogers sang. Maybe because he was tubercular and doomed to an early death. Maybe that was the true South, the best of it strewn across a cornfield at Dunker's Church or littered in front of the cannon on Cemetery Ridge. The worst of it in the Cockney's whip, whistling across a black man's back. When I was growing up, the people in the Victorian and antebellum homes along East Main Street in New Iberia were never hurtful toward me, although my class of people would often be asked to go by the back door. To me, however, they seemed kind. They were not profane, nor harsh, nor curt, and were called genteel. I wasn't sure what the word meant, but it was obviously associated with the way they did things. If a difficult situation came about, such as an argument over money, or a disrespectful remark from a person of humble origins, a lawman or landlord or an employer would appear, and the situation would be settled. It took me a while to understand what those gestures indicated. It might not be 1861 to others, but in our world, the calendar meant nothing, and the mention of a surname would freeze the sweat on a black man's face or leave a white field worker unemployed and not certain his family would eat that night. Serenity along Bayou Teche sometimes was acquired at a heavy price. From its inception, Louisiana has been a home for pirates, brothels, gambling halls, corrupt politicians, legal and illegal slavery, and terrorism. The torch and the whip. The slave insurrection of 1811 in Orleans Parish was the most brutal atrocity in the history of our country. To this day, it is hard to believe it happened. I won't even describe it here. Later on, the White League made General Forrest Ku Klux Klan look silly when they invaded New Orleans and shot former Confederate General James Longstreet and struck a deal with the Republicans to shut down Reconstruction, Angola Plantation on the Mississippi River, became one of the first rental prisons in that nation. It was called Angola Prison or Angola Farm, but hell would have been a more accurate title. Even today, no one knows how many of Angola's convicts died of disease or gunshots or beatings or starvation or the sweat boxes on Camp A. Their bodies are still in the levee along the river, the bones and teeth broken into chips. The opening of the Hattacall Boogie by James Lee Burke. His longest Dave Robichaud novel yet, either 25 or 26 on the list. I think it's 26, but it might be 25. I don't know. But tomorrow at 10:30, tomorrow morning, I'll be talking to James Lee Burke, our 25th interview. Is he my favorite person to interview? Well, we've done 25 interviews. Maybe so. Tune in tomorrow. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.